And World Affairs Council presenting its Global Forum on the Middle East, featuring Ambassador Ryan Crocker on June 3rd at 5 p.m. at Southern New Hampshire University. Details at wacnh.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The Defense Department is preparing to trim $50 billion from its budget in anticipation of the next fiscal cliff, cuts that will automatically go into effect if Congress and the President don't reach a deficit reduction deal by March 1st. And as military officials draw up their plans, they're making it quite clear they're not happy about it. Senior military brass have told Congress that the cuts will devastate our armed services, put U.S. readiness at a tipping point, and create a hollow force incapable of defending the country's interests. And our guest today, Lawrence Korb, has been in their shoes examining military budgets with an eye toward what's really needed and what isn't. But Korb, an assistant secretary of defense under President Reagan, disagrees with those officers at the Pentagon today. Korb says there's plenty of room to cut military spending, and by far more than the $50 billion now under discussion. He argues that with the Iraq War over, Afghanistan winding down, and many Americans still struggling economically, there's no reason for defense spending to continue to enjoy, as Korb puts it, unlimited funding. Lawrence Korb is in the Granite State this week as part of the World Affairs Council of New Hampshire's Global Tipping Point series. He spoke last night at UNH in Manchester and joins us today. And let's hear from you this hour. Do you agree that large cuts could be made in military programs without sacrificing national security? Or do you worry, as some on Capitol Hill do, that major reductions could harm military readiness, make the U.S. more vulnerable? And do you think the U.S. might need to rethink its military priorities? Let other nations take the lead in some global conflicts. Give us a call. Tell us what you think. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org is the address, or you can post a comment on our Facebook page. And Larry Korb, welcome back. Nice to see you. It's been about 10 years.
Good to see you again.
Well, welcome to New Hampshire. And, you know, getting back inside the Beltway where you do most of your business, Larry, tons of talk, as you know, and people who are worrying publicly about cutting the Pentagon budget, from Defense Secretary Leon Panetta to top military officials to Senate Armed Service Committee members like John McCain and New Hampshire's Kelly Ayotte. They're all making the case that this is dangerous, even cutting just $50 billion, never mind the levels you're talking about. Are they misguided, Larry? Are they wrong when they say cutting $50 billion is dangerous?
Well, they're partly correct, because sequestration says you have to cut everything equally. That's not the way to run, you know, NPR or the Pentagon. You know, if you're going to make reductions, you need to, do them in a smart way. The other is we've waited so long. See, what people don't realize, the fiscal year started the 1st of October. We still don't have a budget for this year. And so basically right now, nobody knows what's going to happen. You can't hire people. You can't give out contracts. So they're right in that sense with, you know, these automatic cuts. What I would argue is we need to step back and take a look and say, okay, where have we been? Where do we want to go? And let's take a look over the next decade and make the, make the reductions. The amount under sequestration, and again, not the process, is about 7% over 10 years, 7% in real terms. When I had the privilege of working for President Reagan, we also had a deficit problem in his second term. Over 4 years, we cut a 10%.
Wow.
So you can do it. But I do agree with the military people and the people running the Pentagon that this is just a stupid way to be doing things with sequestration. We ought to figure out how much we, you know, look at our strategy, see what we need to do to implement it, and develop a long-term plan rather than cutting everything equally.
So you agree the process is messed up, but the numbers, you say, and you've written this in many different venues, we could go a lot bigger than $50 billion.
Well, I mean, $50 billion, an average of $50 billion over 10 years. So I think you can go the $500 billion. Where people are just focusing on this year, no, I think you ought to do it over 10 years. And I would do it slowly. You can't do that much this year because you're already halfway through the fiscal year.
You know, it's interesting what you said, Larry, that right now people are looking at possibly 7% over 10 years. You're saying when you worked for President Reagan, you did a 10% cut in defense spending over just 4 years. What were the conversations like back then?
Well, what happened was that we were concerned about the deficit. And you had a bill passed that was called Graham Rudman Hollings, named after Rudman is very famous, one of the senators I've ever met, and it's too bad, you know, he's passed on, said, look, we got to do something about the deficit. And so everything has to be cut. So initially, the president and my boss, Secretary Weinberger, were not enthusiastic about cutting them. But I think President Reagan realized, as people do today, if you don't have a strong economy, you can't have a strong defense. And so he had run up quite a big deficit in his first term, and so he was willing to make the reductions to move it down.
You're talking about Caspar Weinberger, the
defense
secretary.
Well, yeah, he was not happy about it, but the president basically overruled him because he listened to people like Senator Dole, Senator Rudman, you know, Republicans, you know, Senator, you know, Phil Graham, you know, I mean, these are all very conservative Republicans.
Going back to that time under Reagan, the common narrative is that the Reagan built up U.S. defenses to the point where it forced the Soviet Union to do the same, to the point where it killed their economy, and that's when the USSR began to collapse. How much truth is there to that conventional wisdom about that
buildup? There is an element of truth to that, because what the president decided was, if you will, kind of the Walmart strategy, where you drive other people out of business, that they can't match us, so we're going to have this buildup. And it did have an effect. And, of course, the Soviets initially tried to keep up with us, then they couldn't. And then, of course, when Gorbachev came in. But, you know, the interesting thing is people forget when President Reagan in his second term reached out to Gorbachev, and basically he was criticized by a lot of Republicans, including the person who became Speaker, Newt Gingrich. He called him Neville Chamberlain. And you had people, you know, in the administration like Bob Gates, who went on to become Secretary of Defense under Bush, who was then at the CIA, saying Gorbachev was going to be succeeded by a Stalinist. You know, I mean, so I think, you know, at that time he took a big risk and, you know, it wasn't popular. The other thing that's important with the Soviets, and President Carter should get some credit for this, when they went into Afghanistan, we decided that we were going to lead the resistance. We didn't send American men and women on the ground, but we provided an awful lot of equipment to the Mujahideen. President Carter had started it. President Reagan continued it. And there was even opposition from some of our military people. They did not want to send the Mujahideen, the opposition, the Stinger missiles, because they were afraid they would get into the wrong hands. But they, you know, basically, if you've seen the movie Charlie Wilson's War, you know, that was the turning point, because they could shoot down the Soviet helicopters.
Neville Chamberlain, again, in reference to the British prime minister, seen as not standing up to Hitler. So really kind of an insult.
Oh, yes, it was. Yeah.
How did that experience then under Reagan, Larry, watching this build up and then being a part of this major cut in defense spending at the time? Again, as you said, 10% over 4 years. It's a lot. How does that inform your feelings about what you're hearing on Capitol Hill today?
Well, I think what it does is people overreact whenever you talk about any cuts in any program, and of course in defense. People are concerned because obviously the most important thing the federal government does is protect this country. We do a lot of other things, but that's so if that's not done adequately, then nothing else matters. And I think people don't know the numbers, and they hear, oh, $50 billion in cuts, that's going to be horrible. And you say, wait a second, that would bring the defense budget in 2013 down to $500 billion, which even if you control for inflation is more than we spent on average in the Cold War. But people hear these big numbers and, oh, my goodness, you know. I mean, for example, in the presidential campaign, Governor Romney said, you know, to President Obama, your cuts have brought the Navy back smaller than it was in, you know, in 1916. Where he got that was actually Secretary Panetta said. And it's technically true that, yes, you will. But the Navy's now bigger than it was in 2005, and it's completely different. I mean, you know, an aircraft carrier, you know, with 90, you know, planes on it has got so much more power than, you know, some old, you know, battleship back in 1916. So people hear these things. And what happens is, you know, in the political debate, people are trying to use talking points because a lot of folks can't get into the nitty-gritty. And, you know, if I'm out there in the American public and I say, oh, my goodness, 1916, that's, you know, we weren't prepared for World War One. You know, we can't do that. So I think that's what I hear. And I say, okay, let's relax. Let's go and take a look at the facts, where we are and where we need to go.
Our phone number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, today in the exchange, Lawrence Korb is with us, national security expert, former assistant defense secretary under President Reagan. We're talking about his call for deep cuts in military spending, cuts he says that would make sense and still keep the nation safe, but cuts deeper than many military officials want to go. Join us, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Do you agree that the military could sustain much larger cuts than often mentioned? Or do you worry that major reductions would harm military readiness, make the U.S. more vulnerable? Let's hear from you. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. So you said people tend to overreact when talking about military cuts. Who's overreacting, Larry? Leon Panetta, for example, the outgoing defense secretary. Is he overreacting? He's been talking a lot about this.
Well, sure. I mean, you got to realize that when people become, they get an appointment to an agency, they become advocates for the agency.
So nobody goes before Congress and says, please give us less.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting. If you look at Secretary Panetta's thing, when he was at the Office of Management and Budget, he wanted to cut it more than Dick Cheney did, you know, who was Secretary of Defense and who was on the House Budget Committee. So, and even my boss, the late Cap Weinberger, a super guy, he had been head of then called HEW, before he came over. He had also been at OMB. He was known as Cap the Knife at OMB. Then we got to the Pentagon, he took on a different thing. So I think you got to understand that you're expected to do that. I could give you things from my own experience where people got mad at me for not supporting the Pentagon position on everything. So you're expected. But I think you have to sit back and have to say, you know, and one thing that's so important, you could spend the whole federal budget on defense, but you can't buy perfect security. You always take risk. And I think you have to recognize that, because if we got $550 billion and I say, go to 500, you'll say, oh, my goodness, you know, that's going to create risk. Well, okay, during the Cold War, which we won, we only spent on average about 450, and so that's controlling for inflation.
We will take a lot more of your calls after a short break, and you can join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
It's The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mike Daniele, and for Dan Colgan. You can take NHPR with you wherever you go with the NHPR app, available for Apple and Android devices. It lets you stream NHPR and classical NH 24/7. You download all of our podcasts and receive news updates throughout the day. And it keeps you updated on all the discounts you're entitled to with your NHPR member card. Download the NHPR app today. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from the NHHEAF, or the NEAF Network Organizations, working with the New Hampshire Department of Education to increase the college aspirations of local students at imcollegebound.org. And from HEB Engineers, supporting New Hampshire communities for over 38 years and proud to be employee-owned, online at hebengineers.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, national security expert Lawrence Korb is with us. He's arguing that with the Iraq War over, Afghanistan winding down, and many Americans still struggling, defense spending should go down, possibly dramatically. He says there's no reason for it to continue to enjoy, as he puts it, unlimited funding. Lawrence Korb is in the Granite State this week as part of the World Affairs Council of New Hampshire's Global Tipping Point series. He spoke last night at UNH in Manchester. He joins us today, and let's hear from you. The number here on The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post a comment on our Facebook page. And Larry, let's go right to our callers now. And Joshua's calling in Bristol. Hi, Joshua, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Yeah, my question was, I just recently exited the Marine Corps, And, you know, they're all talking about all these various cuts, 10%, 15%. If you look back at the Gulf of Tonkin, Korea, I mean, almost everywhere you go back, all these blowback political issues. If we just focused on diplomacy and cutting back all the alphabet soup agencies' blowback problems, wouldn't that save a lot of our money? And we could go back to maybe a Defense Department, which we call it now instead of a War Department, what it really is.
Thank you. And I know you've talked about this, looking more at so-called soft power, diplomacy, humanitarian assistance.
Yes, Joshua, that's a great question, and thanks for your service in the Marines. I tell people if I had it to do over again, I would join the Marines. Rather, I was a naval flight officer because you never get out. You're always – you're not a former Marine. You know, you're always in there. Yes, one of the things we've looked at over is what we call a unified national security budget, where you take the amount that the Pentagon gets, Homeland Security gets, and the State Department and say, given that amount, could we spend that money more effectively to, you know, protect us? In other words, a certain amount of foreign aid is going to make sure that you don't have instability in a country, which then will lead to, you know, a group like Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb or any of these, you know, groups coming in. So this is what we need to do. And, of course, once you commit military force and you put young American men and women on the ground in a different culture, a lot of people don't understand. I think when we do it, we really do it for the best of intentions, you know, most of the time. But when you get there, people don't see that. They see us as another colonial power. I remember in Iraq, when I went there the first time, a Shiite a scholar said to me, "You're saying the same thing the British did when they came. We came as liberators, not occupiers."
We're here to you know help what
I
mean? You.
And so that's how they looked at us. So military force should be a last resort, not a first resort. And if you spend the money correctly on Homeland Security and on the State Department, you will probably have less reason to have to use military force.
Joshua, thanks for calling. It's good to hear from him because of his service. So he's definitely invested in some of the issues that you're talking about. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You know, real quickly, Larry, following up on Joshua's point, what do you think about the way the military is used sometimes, a mission of humanitarian aid, a mission of winning hearts and minds? You know, some military people say, no, that's not what I'm trained for. Give that to USAID. Give that to the State Department. What do you think?
Well, I think we should. The problem is if they don't get the funding, they can't do it. See, and that's the key. You see what happens when a defense budget goes up before the Congress. You know, people have a vested interest. Like the folks up here at the Portsmouth Naval Yard, they keep people employed. But when I say I'm going to give money, let's say a year ago, I want to give money to Mali. People say, why do you want to do that? We got problems at home. And so you can cut that with no political blowback here. And so that's what happens. And these agencies don't get the money that they should. And if you ask Americans, what percentage of the gross domestic product do you think we spend or what percentage of the budget goes to foreign aid? Oh, they'll say 10, 20%. It's like 1%, see? And so there is that perception. And yeah, sometimes when we give money, it is wasted and there's corruption and things. So people will highlight that to cut that budget.
Well, it is interesting when the public talks about what we as a nation could cut from our federal budget. And we've talked to listeners about this over the many years. You're right. People often do say foreign aid. Let's cut that. So the public in general doesn't seem on board with you there, Larry.
No, they don't. And that's why you require leadership, you know, in the Congress and the White House to make that case. You know, one of the most successful non-military things we ever did was the Marshall Plan. You'd have a tough time getting that through Congress today, okay? You know, basically it helped Europe, you know, get themselves back on their feet. You know, some of those elections, like in Italy, they could have gone communist, okay? But we were able to do that, and really that was kind of the halt of the Soviet expansionism into Europe.
Let's take another call, and Josh is waiting in Berlin. Hi, Josh, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura, and how do you guess? I understand that under the Reagan administration, they had that classic case of a $500 hammer. And I know that there's a lot of corruption high up where they end up going on the board of directors of some big company that has very lavish contracts with the government. So I can understand that kind of a waste. But what I can't understand is that they have the National Guard that really is meant for state emergencies and to help out the various states in those areas here in the United States. And they're spreading them so thin where they're going into Africa now, supposedly 35 countries in Africa. And I also believe that they're leaving us very vulnerable to an uncertain world like North Korea. When they launched missiles towards us, one of them hit the Aleutian Islands there or nearby. They said, you know, we really don't have any kind of a defense shield against missiles, and we don't have any kind of a civil defense program. Even Britain, Russia, China have extensive programs. And I'd like your guest opinions on these things or comments on these.
Thanks a lot, Josh. Yeah.
Yeah, Josh, I mean, you raised an awful lot of issues here, so let me take them. One of the points that I've made recently is in since 2001, the base budget, the non-war budget, has doubled, okay? And that's important because what we're talking about here in these cuts is not the war funding. We're talking about the base budget. Now, what happens when your budget goes up that quickly, Bob Gates used the term gusher of defense spending, people were not as careful with management as they should have been. Do you realize in the last decade, we spent $50 billion on weapons we ended up canceling? Because people knew the money was there, so they didn't have to worry. If you look at the 95 programs that the Pentagon is actually, you know, has undertaking now, the cost overruns on those programs, according to the General Accountability Office, is $400 billion. So, yes, there are things. And I would argue if you cut the budget, say, $50 billion, you know, people would end up being more careful. They would have tougher management, you know, when they did it. I could go on and on about the toilet seat. I must tell
you that
when
they put $600 toilet seat or something like that.
When they put me in charge of that, I got Lockheed to give it to us for nothing. But after that, your point about the National Guard is well taken because, see, when we went to a volunteer military, we said the volunteer military is a peacetime force. Therefore, if we get involved in wars, we'll call up the Guard and Reserve as a strategic reserve, and then go to selective service. We didn't go to selective service.
Meaning a draft.
So you're right. We way overextended it. And it really was a tragedy because not only did we leave ourselves vulnerable, but we deployed people too often without enough, you know, without enough time at home. In terms of missile defense, we've had a difficult time because of the fact that you have a physics problem. Missile defense works fine if the missile stays in the atmosphere. It goes out of the atmosphere, and they use decoys. All the scientists will tell you you can't get it. Though a lot of folks think you should keep trying. President Reagan, who came up with the idea, would not deploy it because he said it doesn't work yet. So we could keep testing, and hopefully we'll have a breakthrough. But boy, it's pretty tough. But you can use it in the theater, like we did in the first Gulf War, the Patriots, when Saddam was sending the Scuds, because they stayed in the atmosphere. And you're right. I mean, as Joshua mentioned, you know, we should be the Department of Defense, not the, you know, kind of going around the world. We can't. Not every problem in the world affects us. Not everything that happens is a direct threat to national security. And so we can't solve them. Some things you have to live with. Now, as Americans, we don't like that. If you told Americans back in 1946, at the end of World War II, that the Cold War would last 50 years, people would say, no way, let's get it over with. Well, you got to be patient.
Let's fix it. Yeah, we're a fix-it nation.
Yeah. And so some things you're going to have to live with. You can't send the Marines in every time, you know, you have a particular problem.
Well, it's interesting, and people are looking at that right now with the French involvement in Mali. But I don't think we'll go there right now, Larry. I want to take another call and also invite you to join us with your questions and comments about this idea of military spending, how our guest today says it's time to cut back on military spending after 10 years of what he says was unlimited spending. What do you think about that? Do you think that that is the way to go, or do you worry that it could, as many military officials are saying, leave us with a hollow defense force, unable to provide for covering our nation's basic interests? Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And Larry, let's take another call. This is Pat in Durham. Hi, Pat. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I completely agree that we can look at, and I'm an active duty. I've been on for more than 20 years, still serving. And I completely agree that we can reduce our military spending, but we need to go back and define what the military is meant to do. Right now, I cannot accomplish my mission, and many of my fellow folks cannot accomplish their mission as posted with people they've got without making serious compromises for both safety and mission accomplishment. And there's a good chance that I might have just lost another one of my former folks because of that.
Pat, can you, I'm sorry to interrupt, but this is real interesting. Can you tell me when you say, I can't accomplish my mission, can you tell me a little bit about that?
We have got a mission. Give me an example. So I'm Air Force. When I got in the Air Force, we had almost 800,000 people in it. We dropped down to 440,000, and we thought, wow, that's going to be tough. We're on the way down to 300,000 right now. That's okay if you give me a smaller mission, but you give me a bigger mission. I mean, since 91, my mission has increased significantly. You know, we are involved in every continent right now, literally, including Antarctica, in contingency operations. And so you need to reduce my – and what we need to do is tell the American people, you, sir, need to be honest with us, stop lying to us, and tell us, hey, we cannot give you perfect security like you want. Well, what we have to do is set our priorities, and there is going to be danger. Americans are going to die, but this is what we can afford because this is what we can afford.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much. Great point, Pat. And kind of following up on what you said and what an earlier caller said, Larry – time to talk about maybe we can't do it all. We can't be in all corners of the globe.
Well, I think Pat raises a great point. You know, under the Bush administration, George W. Bush, the motto was, you know, unilateral if we can, multilateral only if we must. Obama has switched that to multilateral if we can, unilateral only if we must. So you take Libya, right? In Libya, the United States spent about $1 billion. No Americans were killed. We provided what we could, like drones and intelligence and all that. But we didn't do all the attacking. Okay, it was done by, you know, the French and the British and the United Arab Emirates. Similarly, you know, you take a look at the situation in Mali. The French have taken the lead. We're supporting them. So if we have less people, you know, they're not going to be doing those things. And I think that's what you have to take a look at. And, you know, when you take a look at your missions now, last year, Secretary Panetta and President Obama said, we're going to pivot to Asia. I don't like that term. But what they were saying is we're going to give priority with the marginal dollars to dealing with the situation in Asia. We did this after Vietnam. We put our attention on Europe. So, I mean, you do that. And Pat echoes a point I made. Even if we still had 800,000 people in the Air Force, you can't buy perfect security. But you have to, you know, recognize what the mission is, and make sure that adequately. You know, we have less people in the military now than we did in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s because of technology. You know, you can get more from each individual person.
Here's an email from Arnie in Concord. And thanks for that call, Pat. Arnie says, Chuck Hagel, and this is the incoming defense secretary. Has he been approved yet?
No. His hearing's tomorrow.
It's John Kerry who has recently
been
approved Secretary of State.
Yesterday.
All right. Chuck Hagel is an advocate of moving towards zero nuclear weapons worldwide. Would reducing the emphasis on nuclear weapons in U.S. defense plans be a reasonable way to cut the budget without harming actual defense? Arnie, good question. What do you think, Larry?
Well, there's no doubt about it. In fact, Chuck is a member of Global Zero. But their position was this: you'd love to get rid of nuclear weapons completely, which is something President Reagan endorsed and something President Obama's endorsed. But he says right now you should go down from 1,550 operational to about 1,000. And his position is supported by retired Marine General Cartwright, who was head of the Strategic Command and vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And this is a critical point because we're at a point right now where if we don't cut the number of nuclear weapons, we're going to have to modernize all three legs of the triad, the submarine-launched ballistic missiles, the land-based missiles, and new bombers. To build a new ballistic missile submarine, the Navy estimates about $7 billion each I would say it won't come in at that. But stop and take a look at this. You have a ballistic missile submarine with 24 tubes that it can fire, 24 missiles. Each missile has at least 5 warheads. How many do you need? The Air War College, not some liberal think tank, has done a paper saying to have deterrence in the 21st century, all you need is 311 weapons. So, yes, you can do it. And this is a way that you can, I think, get good savings. And I think most military people would support that because, you know, I remember Colin Powell saying, you spend this money on nuclear weapons, you can't take care of the troops or take care of the things that Pat was talking about. And really, you don't need it. And the good thing, not only could we save money, but it would be an example to the rest of the world that the United States is leading here. We should stop the proliferation in places like North Korea and Iran.
Well, when you talk about nuclear subs, though, you're on thin ice here in New Hampshire because so many people work at the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard, which repairs and rebuilds nuclear
well,
submarines.
Basically, we do. We're not getting rid of them, okay? We're not going to build as many new ones, and you still do have, you know, the existing Trident submarines.
Let's take another call if we could, Larry. This is Tom in East Dummerston, Vermont. Hi, Tom. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. Thank you. I want to comment on the impact of Reagan on the collapse of the Soviet Union. My recollection is that Gorbachev and Shevardnadze came into office before Reagan, and both came in with the perception that the Soviet economy was in trouble. They initiated glasnost and perestroika, and in doing so, they loosened the political system and the economy. And when they loosened it, it had took on a life of its own, and the Soviet Union was headed toward collapse, regardless of whether Carter stayed in power or Reagan was elected.
You know, Tom, this is a good point. And I think what we were trying to say before, Larry, was the conventional wisdom or the narrative is that Reagan's defense buildup helped push the Soviet Union. But he's absolutely right. There were many changes underway in the Soviet Union even before Reagan's defense buildup.
Well, Tom, I think your history is a little off. Gorbachev doesn't take power until 1984. We still had Brezhnev, one of the last of the old co-warriors in there who had overthrown Khrushchev. There's no doubt about the fact that the Soviet Union was living on borrowed time. Their archives are now open, and we find out that, yes, Reagan did send a signal, probably accelerated it. But I think the more important thing is that Reagan was willing to go talk to Gorbachev. And, you know, once he did that, and they, in fact, remember, they were going to get rid of all nuclear weapons at Reykjavik. That, I think, accelerated, and he is quite right. When they instituted perestroika, that they couldn't control it after that.
All right. Tom, thanks a lot for that call, and we'll take more after a short break.
NHPR listeners support the arts in our community.
What got you involved in this Fringe Festival concept, Linda?
I'm a theater freak.
Thomas Adams' first kiss and his lifelong love of photography happened more than 50 years ago.
Museums, theaters, music, anything that piques our interest. You can let NHPR listeners know about your event by becoming an underwriter. To learn about marketing your business on NHPR, visit the business support page at nhpr.org.
It's 9:39. You're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. Good morning. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from People's United Bank, offering home equity loans to help manage individual financial needs. People's United Bank, what know-how can do. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. And from Waste Management, with a reminder to practice the 4 R's whenever possible. Reduce, reuse, recycle, and recover the resource. Additional information at thinkgreen.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, defense expert Lawrence Korb discusses national security, cuts to military spending, and we want to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Do you agree that large cuts could be made to the military without compromising national security? Or do you worry that our defenses would be hollowed out, as some say, by large cuts? We've also been talking about the U.S. role in the world. Some have said that the U.S. needs to change its military priorities, let other nations take the lead in some of the world's conflicts. Give us a call. Tell us what you think. 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And Larry, before we go back to our listeners, I wanted to ask you about the politics of this. We have heard a lot of pushback on Capitol Hill and from top military leaders like Defense Secretary Panetta, like the Chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff. They've all gone to Congress and said, no, don't do this. But I have read recently that there's sort of a new emerging political coalition in favor of large defense cuts.
Well, what has happened for the longest time, many Democrats were afraid to cut defense because they would be received as weak, kind of the second coming of George McGovern. Well, after President Obama got bin Laden, they're not as concerned about, you know, being seen as weak on defense. And you have the so-called Tea Party people, libertarians, who say, you know, basically, we would rather cut defense than raise taxes and all that. It's very interesting. Everybody knows who Grover Norquist is, the guy who says, you know, no taxes. I was at a meeting with him one time, and I said, well, would you have raised taxes to pay for the wars? He says, that's the problem. The Pentagon has plans to invade Canada, you know. I mean, they just, we can, you know, we can cut that back. So you do have that, and you have, you know, Ron Paul's son, Rand Paul. In fact, he's giving a speech, I think, today at Heritage saying, hey, you know, we're not supposed to be saving, you know, saving the world. So, yeah, I think you're beginning to, you know, have that come together, and it'll be fascinating. I hope we don't do sequester. I'm an optimist. I don't think we will. But there'll be a deal that will cut defense by at least $100 billion over the next 10 years as part of whatever we decide. And they'll make cuts in, you know, other programs and do something about Social Security, raising the amount of money you pay taxes on, and maybe means testing Medicare. So I think you'll have that. But there will be more cuts in defense. And I think you will find this coalition of sort of very conservative libertarian Republicans and liberal Democrats.
And yet cuts always run into the very local political problem, which is, again, BAE Systems in Nashua, major employer here in New Hampshire and a major defense contractor. And we mentioned already the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard. So it's one thing to, you know, support reductions in the Pentagon budget in theory. It's another thing when it comes down to your home district.
Well, you know, I live in Virginia, and they told me if I voted for Obama, we're going to lose 200,000 jobs, you know, during the campaign. Right now, with the economy being where it is, I can understand why communities are concerned. But if you take a look at it, the least efficient way for the government to create jobs is defense spending. You put it in education, you put it in health, even tax cuts will create more jobs. Now, it will take a while, and obviously people, you know, will be affected. But one of my responsibilities when I was in government was installations or bases. And basically what we found is after 5 years, if the community got together and took advantage of all the programs, they were actually better off. And, you know,
at you mean after the base was closed?
After the, and, you know, even if, you know, for example, you know, you were building F-22s, okay, no matter if you build them all, eventually it's going to end, okay? I mean, you can't keep building. So at some point, you will stop a particular system. So I think we need to, you know, need to recognize that. But, I mean, that's why Eisenhower talked about the military-industrial, you know, complex. It's tough, and I can understand why folks in a community would be concerned.
Let's take another call. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, too, if you'd like. And let's go to Wells River, Vermont. And Bob is on the air. Hi, Bob.
Yes, hello. Good morning.
Morning.
I'm curious to know, it seems pretty clear to me that as careful as Obama is, he's made it quite clear that we're not going to let Iran get hold of a nuclear weapon. And within the context of the withering sanctions we've already placed on them, they still seem to be able to maintain this high level of rhetoric. And so will we be looking foolish, and is it even possible or thoughtful to consider this sort of sequester with this looming threat on the horizon, especially with their control over the Straits of Hormuz and what I would think would be an obvious retaliation to shut down the Straits of Hormuz and that incredible effect it would have on the world economy?
Yeah, that's a great point, Bob. And he's right. There are threats. It's not like the world is, you know, safe now that we're disengaged from Iraq and winding down in Afghanistan. Great point, Bob. Thank you.
I think it's important to keep in mind that even if you did sequester, not the process, but the amount, we would still be spending more than the rest of the world combined. So it's not like we're going back to, you know, before World War I. The other thing is, if you count our allies in spending, that's 80% of the world spending. I mean, the second largest, the European Union, they're our allies in NATO. And, you know, if you were dealing with the threat from Iran, for example, and you didn't build 12 new ballistic missile submarines, you only built 10, that's not going to have an impact because those 10 would still have, you know, thousands of warheads on there. The priority is given to the Navy, as, you know, we talked about here with the new concept of the air-sea battle. And so, therefore, you're not going to be cutting back on naval ships. We have the fifth fleets in Bahrain that can keep open the Strait of Hormuz. They run exercises, their exercises there. And remember this, if you cut today, for most cases, you're not going to see it. I mean, the weapon systems that we use today were built when Carter and Nixon were there. I mean, the aircraft carriers. Some of them were built when I was there. And these things last 50 years. So if you say, oh, my goodness, if we cut today, we can't do that. No, maybe 20 or 30 years you won't be able to. So I think you have to put it, you know, in that context. And if you should attack Iran, you would be using bunker buster bombs on B-2s. I mean, that would pretty much what you do. We've already got the B-2s, which we bought to deal with the Soviet Union, and so you could do that. I mean, you get into the whole other question about whether you should, but that's a different question. But you'd have the military capability to do it.
Here's a bigger question coming out of your question, Bob, and thank you so much for being with us. So when you look at some of the threats facing us today, the national security threats, Larry, you've got Iran that he mentioned. You've got North Korea and their nuclear ambitions. You've got Al-Qaeda emerging, growing in Africa. You've got the constant fear of terrorism here at home, you know, whether it's a dirty bomb or another type of 9/11 or something coming in on a food cargo. We've all heard about how our imports are not very well monitored. How well calibrated or how well matched is this defense spending that we're doing to that threat today? Are we still fighting the wars of 20, 30 years ago, or are we really aimed and ready at today's threats?
Well, I think part of it was still buying weapons that were effective in the Cold War. And I think, you know, we've got to get over that. What we are increasing, even with the defense down cuts from the high level, is special forces. Because that's what you use. I mean,
in these types of
right.
Sort
I
of
mean, for example, in a $550 billion budget, special forces get $11 billion. So you can easily increase them, even if you cut the rest of it. You're using drones, which don't cost nearly as much as aircraft and don't require as many people, you know, to fly. So that's the direction that we're moving in. I mean, one of the threats that we got to deal with. It's called cyber attacks. But the cyber command is going to increase the number of people from 900 to 4,900, not 2.2 million like we have active and reserve. So, yeah, you can do this with less people and deal with the threats. If you said to me, you know, I mean, in terms of like, you know, we got Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb and all this kind of stuff. They are a threat, but they're not an existential threat to the homeland. We would like
not yet anyway.
Well, they're not yet. And I would say no. I mean, because if you want to start a group and call yourself Al-Qaeda, you can. This is not bin Laden's group that was very careful in planning. Now, could they in a number of years? And I think that's why it's important. We're bombing in Yemen. You know, I was in Uganda last year. We trained Ugandan forces to fight in Somalia to get al-Shabaab, which was the type of thing. But that doesn't require Americans. And what they're trying to do in Mali, and the French want to go, and you're going to have an African group come in because it's more of a threat to them. And I think that's what we have to do is sort of help others move, use our unique capabilities, but not try and solve all these problems by ourselves.
So if the need in response to today's threats is smaller, smarter, nimbler, use whatever word you want, why are we still buying this stuff from the Cold War?
Well, again, you know, it's our habits dry, hard to break habits. You know, for example, we kept buying the F-22, which was built to deal with the Soviet Union. I'll never forget when the Air Force was trying to push it. The Secretary of the Air Force was on the NewsHour, and Jim Lehrer said to him, well, why do you need this program? He said, well, you know, we got to deal with the Soviets. He says, no, they collapsed. Oh, okay. And so then he said, well, we want to be better than the French Mirages. And Lara said, well, wait a second, they're our allies. And he said, well, we have to deal with the F-16s. He said, we made them. The Air Force said, well, we sold them around the world. So, yeah, you were kind of – we got 187 of them at, you know, $350 million a copy. You know, they didn't use in Iraq and Afghanistan now. So, I mean, those are the type of things. And now we're going to buy the F-35, the Joint Strike Fighter, which is way over budget. And, you know, you can continue to buy what you're doing, the F-18Es and Fs and the F-16s. They will be able to deal with the threats that you face.
Let's take another call. And this is Diane in North Sutton. Hi, Diane. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hi. It's a pleasure to talk to both of you. Yes, what I was wondering, it has to do with perception being reality. If John Bolton and Condoleezza Rice believed in the sovereignty of the United States, as other people do, if other countries such as North Korea and China believe, if they see that we're cutting our spending, how are we perceived as a nation that is supposed to be the leader of the free world?
Gotcha. So the question, Larry, what do you think? It's a good one. If we are cutting dramatically our defense spending, do other countries say, aha, they're getting weak?
Well, I think you got to go back and talk about where we are. And in other words, yes, if they believe some of the rhetoric that's put out by people who don't want to cut it. But if you
like
say,
Leon Panetta.
Yeah. If you say that even if we cut $50 billion, we will still be spending more than we did on average in the Cold War and during the 80s, controlling for inflation. So it's not. And we account for more spending than the Chinese, Russians, and everybody else combined. So I think that's why you got to be careful with the message, because Diane is right. If people say, oh, my goodness, you know, they're going back to 1916, you know, then, yeah, but it's not. And that's why I think it's important, and I appreciate the opportunity to come on here and put this thing into perspective. Okay, if you can't, if you cut the $50 billion, you'd be down to $500 billion. If you can't defend the United States in this day and age at $50 billion, get another job. I mean, you know, that's more than in the 80s when we had Reagan and Bush, again, controlling for inflation. So, you know, when Richard Nixon left office, and again, put it in today's dollars, we're spending about $300 billion on defense. You still had the Cold War. You had the Soviet Union. So, I mean, Eisenhower was like 280. So, yeah.
And what are we at now? Remind us.
Well, we're at 550 before any type of cuts.
And the wars, Afghanistan and Iraq,
they're
off budget.
That's off budget. Here's another
thing. We're not even talking about those.
Here's another thing. When we went to those wars, we should have raised taxes to pay for them. Had we do it, we wouldn't have this fiscal problem that we have now.
Let's take one more call if we could. And Jason's in Stratton. Hi, Jason. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Very interesting conversation today. Real quick, I think what seems to be going on in the minds of a lot of people of all kinds of political persuasion is that why do the laws of capitalism not apply to the Defense Department, which is all about, over time, delivering more bang for the buck, better products, better defense that doesn't cost more? And I think people have to understand that after 9/11, you know, it turned out to be a bit of a gold rush. It turned out to be, you know, no spending is too much spending. And as I think it was in a Frontline special that Dana Priest headed, you know, there really hasn't been a lot of proof that all this spending on all kinds of technologies directly relates to us being safer, even though there hasn't been another attack. So why? They're just going to have to understand that the laws of capitalism prevail, which is we should be getting a better Defense Department for less money.
Well, Jason,
I mean, these are the people who believe this. I'd like his comment on that.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Jason.
Well, I think Jason's right. After 9/11, we panicked, and the Pentagon, you know, Bob Gates called it the gusher of defense spending. And this is the base budget, not the war budget. And we bought things like the F-22, which, again, had been built to deal with the Soviet, you know, Soviet Union.
Not a terrorist hiding in a subway.
And I think, go back to the point that was made earlier by, I think it was Bob from the Air Force. Yes, you have less people because you're supposed to be, you know, less manpower intensive like any other, you know, organization is today, because your weapons are supposedly more effective. And what happens is, you know, if you go back and you take a look and say, when was the Pentagon really run well and we get bang for the buck? Two times. One under Nixon, when you had Melvin Laird and his deputy was David Packard from Mueller Packard. They got, and you know who else did a great job as Secretary of Defense? Dick Cheney, because his deputy was Don Atwood from General Motors, and they kept the cost down, and we got more bang for the buck. Don Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz just seemed completely unaware of what was happening. They didn't want to manage. They're both good guys, but they wanted to run wars. Well, nobody was home managing the Pentagon. And so to the extent, you know, if Hagel is confirmed, I hope he goes out and hires, you know, the current version of, you know, General Motors or, you know, a Hewlett Packard, you know, somebody from a big company that knows how to manage, because that's right. And I got to tell you, from my own experience, you deal with these titans of industry, they're tough people. You need one of them. I tell you, I knew David Packard. You wouldn't mess with him. Okay. So that's right. Yeah, you should. And I would argue it doesn't have a resource problem. It has a management problem.
The Pentagon.
Pentagon, yeah. And that's what we need to get a hold of. Okay, $50 billion on weapons that gave us nothing? What could we do with that $50 billion? How many more Marines or Air Force people could we buy?
Or Special Forces, as you talked about.
Yeah.
Well, Larry, interesting as always. Great to have you here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you
for having me. I appreciate it.
That's Lawrence Korb, again, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information, an adjunct professor at Georgetown University, and a former assistant secretary of defense under Ronald Reagan. As we said, he was speaking in New Hampshire last night at UNH in Manchester as part of a series from the World Affairs Council of New Hampshire. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Faith Mikesell. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, budgetary back and forth. The House has rejected revenues from the Senate's gambling bill, while senators have said no to higher taxes on gasoline and cigarettes. Meanwhile, Governor Hassan says she still wants to fund her priorities, but after these votes, finding that money will be difficult and cuts may be in store. We'll examine how it might all play out. Email us at nhpr.org and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.
It's 9:59, and you're listening to New Hampshire Public Radio. Good Memorial Day to you. I'm Mike Daniele, in for Dan Colgan. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from Culture One Stop, bringing key information to board members at cultural nonprofits. May the 31st at the